Hello and welcome to the Scottish Housing News Podcast with Jimmy Black and me, Kieran Finlay. We're ticking on towards episode 50 of this podcast, and one of the many things I've learned along the way is that a huge number of the issues we've discussed in one way or another can be solved by increasing the supply of new homes. So today we want to focus on an important part of that process of making this happen, and that is planning. The results of a recent survey published by our sister publication, Scottish Construction Now, made for sobering reading. It found that the statutory timeframe for the turnaround of planning applications has been routinely breached in Scotland, with readers blaming under-resourced planning departments and the implementation of NPF4 for increasing delays.
Now, it's worth pointing out that planners don't accept all of these criticisms, and discussions are underway at a ministerial level on what can be done to bring all interested parties together to find solutions. So with that, we're speaking to a house builder to hear their side. Janice Russell is the Managing Director at MacTaggart Construction, which delivers hundreds of homes every year for Scotland's registered social landlords.
And the introduction of NPF4 has had other implications. So I'm pleased to say we're also joined by Cameron Gregg, a Senior Associate in Morton Fraser's litigation department, to hear about a planning appeal called in by the Scottish Government, which essentially pits NPF4 against an existing local development plan. First of all, Janice, thanks for coming on to the podcast. MacTaggart is a name recognised by many in the social housing sector, but for those who may not be familiar, could you give us an idea of the number of homes that the company builds each year? How many of those are for RSLs, and what are the clients? Who are the clients that you work with?
Thanks for having me on this afternoon. We build around 750 affordable homes every year, and we work for a range of RSL clients, including small housing associations, right up to larger associations like Link Group and Wheatley Group. We also deliver direct for some local authorities, including West Lothian Council and North Lanarkshire Council.
In an interview for Scottish Construction Now, you highlighted the challenges of getting developments through the planning process and how the average timescale for approval has changed in recent times. Could you expand on that?
Yes, we have around 2,000 units in our construction pipeline across Scotland, and it is taking at least 12 to 14 months to get a small application processed through planning, and major applications are taking anything up to and beyond 2 years. So there's a significant impact to our business and to our clients in terms of affordable housing delivery. There's significant cost implications due to delays. But having said that, there are some local authority planning departments who process applications much quicker than that. So it's very difficult to pinpoint what the actual issue is, because you've got in one local authority area, you've got planners who will work with you, identify what they're looking for early on in the process, and you provide them that information, and the planning application goes quite smoothly. In other areas, it's almost a drip feed of information, so it's quite challenging, and I can understand everyone's frustration with planning, but I think perhaps that is equally felt with planning officers.
It's worth pointing out the results of the survey that I mentioned at the top. 96.3% of respondents believe that their business has been damaged by planning delays, with the same number saying that the situation has got worse since the pandemic. And as many as 99.3% don't believe that the situation is going to get better anytime soon. Within that, there was responses to the survey where readers raised many issues for delays, such as the implementation of NPF4, planning staff working from home, or using outdated technology to process applications. Are these on your radar at all, Janice?
Yes, I think one of the major challenges just now is the implementation of NPF4. It was introduced on the 13th of February this year. We're 7 months down the line, and planning officers and council officials who have to make decisions around planning applications still don't have a full understanding of the implications of MPF4. There's been no training, there's been no guidance issued, well, very little guidance issued around certain elements of MPF4. And I think that is probably one of the major stumbling blocks around the planning system just now. And it will take a period of time for everyone to become familiar with MPF4. And the challenge will be how we play catch up in terms of affordable housing delivery once we get consent. Because, for example, we as a business, we've gone from having 26 live sites down to 11, and we've got 14 sites due to start within the next 6 months, all subject to planning approvals that are due to come through considering the requirements of NPF4. And each time you speak to the team about how they're getting on, you know, is this going to start in January? Oh, well, actually, no, it might now be March. So it's impacting us as a business, but we're not the only ones. It's impacting the whole new build sector, including the private sector.
Can we bring Cameron in now? And Cameron, have you got any experience which throws any light in the kind of delays and the difficulties which people are facing? We're going to come to the case that you've been involved in later. But just in general, in your practice, are the things that Janice is saying familiar to you?
Yeah, I think they are. And good afternoon, all, and thank you for having me on the podcast. I think, as Janice says, there is going to be this familiarisation period and by necessity a bedding in process for National Planning Framework 4. You know, this is a nationwide piece of national policy, and it's a lot in it, and it's going to take time before the terms are fully understood and can be implemented at the same sort of pace as perhaps was happening with a more familiar development plan context. There's a lot of stuff in there which planning authorities are now going to have to pick up and consider when they're processing applications, and that's inevitably going to take time and resource. And as Janice says, we'll also hopefully be getting some further guidance which might help to streamline processes. But yes, I think it's something that's felt by both developers and by planning officers.
Something we've been exploring in recent podcasts is laws which are very worthy and a terribly good idea but are completely unenforceable and unachievable. Is the idea of getting planning applications sorted out within 2 months really just, you know, whimsical?
You'd have to ask the local authorities, I think, on that one.
Sorry for interrupting, Cameron. I was going to say, I think the challenge is the number of people that have to be consulted around a planning application. Mm. So, you know, the planning officers are putting out the application for consultation, and the delay sometimes is with the consultees. So it requires engagement from everyone and a collective will to actually improve the system. I don't think it can just be approached from one particular side of the industry or by one particular body. It requires everyone to have that actual will to improve it.
I was the deputy convener of planning in a Scottish city. It was Dundee a few years ago. And one of the things that puzzled me, it was very seldom that any developers ever came to me and said, the planning department are taking forever to sort out our application, can you help? And now councillors are notoriously paranoid about talking to developers because they're worried about getting the jail if you know, there's any kind of impropriety. But nonetheless, there's governance there and they have a governance role. Do you feel, either Cameron or Janice, do you feel comfortable about approaching local authority members to say, you know, hurry up, what's going on? Can't you make something happen here?
Yes, I mean, we would certainly be comfortable. I mean, we operate on an open book policy, so, you know, we've got nothing to hide as a business. I think it's incumbent on council officials to actually understand the implications of the delay. I mean, new housing supports 80,000 jobs, and every new home built supports 3.5 jobs. So a delay in that process will impact on the economy in the local area. There are 39,600 homeless applications, or there were in 22-23, and that number has probably increased significantly this year. So we're actually dealing with a humanitarian crisis in terms of housing in Scotland. So if we need to speak to a council official, we'll have that conversation. And, you know, quite happy for it to be formally noted so that there is no implications of impropriety.
Moving on then to the introduction of NPF4 and its implications, not least when Scottish ministers called in a planning appeal by Miller Homes against West Lothian Council for a proposed 250 home development at Moss End in West Calder. Cameron, could you give a brief summary of this case and its focus on unallocated land?
Yes, I certainly can do. I can't promise that I'll be particularly brief, unfortunately, but I wonder if it might be helpful to take things back to basics. As I'm sure your listeners will be aware, of course, applications for planning permission require to be determined in accordance with the development plan unless material considerations indicate otherwise. And the development plan now comprises the local development plan for an area and, since February this year, a national planning framework 4. So if you have a site and you want to develop it for housing, you'd look at the local development plan and see whether your site was allocated in that plan. And if it is, then you could be reasonably confident that you'd have a good chance of getting your planning application through the process. And that was the case pre-NPF4, and it remains the case now. But if we turn to unallocated sites, pre-NPF4, if a site wasn't allocated, then you would be directed to other provisions in the local development plan, which require what was known as a 5-year effective housing land supply to be maintained. And if you could establish that there was a shortfall in that 5-year effective housing land supply, then that offered you a route towards development consent. And that became known as the tilted balance. So if you had a shortfall in the 5-year effective housing land supply, that would effectively tilt the balance of decision making in favour of granting consent for housing development on unallocated sites.
Sorry, Cameron, just to interrupt there, does that mean that a council isn't delivering the number of homes it said it would by a particular period in time? Would that deem that an unallocated site could be used as housing?
Yes, effectively. There's various ways in which you can approach the calculation of the shortfall, and that's something that's been the subject of a lot of debate and litigation. But yes, that's essentially the point. Okay. If there is this shortfall, then it provides you with an avenue to get your consent. So post-NPF4, we still have that route to consent on unallocated sites in local development plans, because those local development plans were, of course, prepared with a previous national framework, not in the context of NPF4. But now we have a new policy in NPF4, which deals with the exceptional release of housing land, and that's Policy 16F. And Policy 16F, I'll read it out quickly, but it basically says development proposals for new homes on land not allocated for housing in the LDP will only be supported in limited circumstances where, and then there's 3 points. The first, the proposal is supported by an agreed timescale for build-out, and 2, the proposal is otherwise consistent with the planned spatial strategy and other relevant policies, including local living and 20-minute neighbourhoods. 3, and either, and here this is where the debate really centres, there's 4 bullet points. The first is delivery of sites is happening earlier than identified in the deliverable housing land pipeline. This will be determined by reference to 2 consecutive years of the housing land audit evidencing substantial delivery earlier than pipeline timescales and that general trend being sustained. Or second bullet point, the proposal is consistent with policy in rural homes. Or third, the proposal is for smaller scale opportunities within an existing settlement boundary. Or fourth, and this is the final bullet point, the proposal is for the delivery of less than 50 affordable homes as part of a local authority supported affordable housing plan. So this is a new system for the exceptional release of housing land on unallocated sites. And on the face of it, it would appear that we have two systems now. You can either approach it through the local development plan and this shortfall in the five-year effective housing land, or you can approach it through this this new system in policy 16F. And which of those systems is to be used has been the subject of a lot of debate in planning applications that are going through the process just now and planning appeals that are also going through the process. Usually when you've got a new bit of legislation or guidance, lawyers will always look at the transitional arrangements to see if you can get any assistance there. And the transitional arrangements for the adoption of MPF 4 provide that in the event of any incompatibility between a provision of the National Planning Framework and a provision of a local development plan, whichever of them is later in date, is to prevail. So that's the question here, really. Is there an incompatibility between the pre-existing approach in the local development plan and this new approach in policy 16F? So arguments were being exchanged in these various appeals and applications that were going through the process. And read short, there's effectively two arguments. One is that, read in a straightforward manner, the policies are incompatible, as we have two separate systems to the exceptional release of housing land, and as such, the new one in policy 16F is the one that falls to be applied. And on the other hand, the second counter-argument is that there is no incompatibility because policy 16F is currently incapable of sensible application, as it relies upon concepts that haven't yet been introduced. So the first bullet point in part three of that policy is that delivery of sites are happening earlier than identified in the deliverable housing land pipeline. Now, this deliverable housing land pipeline, this is a new concept which hasn't yet been established. So the argument goes that it is impossible to apply this policy because it relies upon concepts that don't yet exist. And as such, if incompatibility was found, then that would be to leave a gap in the policy, which surely can't be what ministers had intended.
Carmelin, can I just ask you, seems like an obvious question, but what's wrong with actually just building on the land that's been allocated? You know, I mean, the Miller Homes application was for, I think, 250 houses in an area where a lot of local people, I think about 343 local people, objected. So, you know, it was a controversial application in itself. So, you know, what's wrong with using the land that's been allocated, that's presumably been agreed for large-scale developments of that kind?
Yeah, well, that would be fine if it's allocated. The point here was that this was unallocated land that we're trying to get consent for.
But that's my question, is why look for consent on unallocated land? Is there not enough land allocated by the council? Is that the problem?
Well, that would be what the developers would say. And historically, that's what they would try to use this five-year shortfall in the five-year effective housing land supply argument. They would say that there isn't enough land allocated, and as such we need to look at unallocated sites in order to deliver the housing that's needed.
Another reason might be that they simply didn't own that piece of land, or you know, the allocated land, or they couldn't get their hands on it, so they're going to look somewhere else.
There's obviously those commercial considerations, absolutely. If developers own land, they're going to want to either get that allocated in a plan, or they might seek consent through this unallocated route.
So, speaking as a former councillor, standing up for the local authority and its ability to make decisions about the way that it, you know, that land is used in its area, I'm going to say that it almost sounds as though developers are trying to get round the system and, you know, basically build in the sites that suit them best. And I don't know if Janice has got any comments here. Maybe this is an unfair interpretation.
I think there are allocated sites which have particular challenges, which lead to increased costs, and therefore make them unviable in terms of delivery. So you find that is a consideration when contractors or developers are looking at allocated sites. It may well be allocated, but whether it's actually deliverable in terms of actual viability because of land conditions or whatever else, then, you know, those all come into the mix when considering an opportunity.
Back to the case, Cameron. While it was live, there was numerous other planning appeals that we're dealing with unallocated sites that were paused pending the outcome of the Moss End appeal. Do you have any indication how many appeals there were and the potential homes, the number of homes that we're talking about?
Yes, so as I was saying, that the matters came to the head in April 2023, and that's when, as you say, the Scottish ministers called in this decision for determination. And their reasoning for that was that the appeal raises national issues in terms of the application of National Planning Framework 4, and as you mentioned there, numerous other live planning appeals for housing on unallocated sites were assisted pending the outcome of that Moss End appeal. In terms of how many, I think it'd be over 10, so you'd be in double figures, but maybe not too much over. I'm not sure of the exact numbers. And in terms of the actual number of houses that we'll be talking about there, I couldn't comment on that either, I'm afraid. But that's the sort of numbers of applications that you'd be looking at. So they called in the application, and then they issued their decision in July this year. And what the ministers decided is that they ultimately decided to dismiss the appeal and refuse planning permission. They concluded that policy 16F of MPF 4 is incompatible with the relevant housing release policy in that case. It was the West Lothian Local Development Plan, with the consequence that policy 16F of MPF 4 prevails and is the approach to be applied when you're looking for the exceptional release of housing land on unallocated sites. The ministers did acknowledge that there are aspects of policy 16F which cannot be satisfied until this concept of the deliverable housing land pipeline is established, but they were nonetheless of the view that 16F has effect from the date MPF 4 was adopted in February, and that's the approach to be followed. So on that reasoning, they found that this old requirement to maintain a five-year effective housing land supply and the housing land requirements that are established in local development plans have no residual role, and likewise the concept of the tilted balance no longer has any effect. So quite a sea change in the policy that's to be applied. That was the finding of that case. I should say that that decision has itself been appealed, so it's now going through the court of session, so it's not necessarily the final word.
Will that then hold up the other paused developments, or could they go ahead and perhaps take a different decision, you know, on a case-by-case basis, or are they all kind of waiting for this one to set a precedent?
I think it's the latter. They could theoretically just go through the system and get their determinations one way or the other, but I think the preference for a lot of developers is to, this is obviously quite unfavourable to unallocated sites, so I think the preference is to wait and see what happens with this court of session action. So I understand that a lot of those planning appeals have been assisted again pending the outcome of this new court of session challenge.
And by the time this decision is reached, could we have a new wave of local development plans that are written with this challenge in NPF 4 in mind, that kind of just deals with this subject, and that's only really the 10 or so appeals that you've mentioned that are affected by this decision?
I think it's going to take quite a bit longer, and this decision will have implications for the short to medium term, because it takes, as you'll know, it takes quite a while for local authorities to get their new local development plans in place. They're all operating on different timescales, so they all have, there'll be a sort of phased implementation, and it'll be a good number of years before every local authority has a new style MPF 4 compliant local development plan. So it'll be some time yet, I suspect.
I think they're looking at 2028 for the new wave of local development plans coming out. So hopefully the court session will not take 5 years to make a ruling.
I can imagine that politicians who have crafted MPF4 are tearing their hair out now, because there is the minimum all-tenure housing land requirement. The MPF4 plan suggests that local authorities should actually set aside more land than that requirement specifies. The idea is to get more land, more houses, all done more quickly. But it sounds as though the argument is being made that what's happened with Moss End will constrain the supply of land, will actually make it harder to release land to get room to build on. So what's happened? How is a policy which is set out to create more opportunities for house building turned into something that actually squeezes the supply?
I think the focus of NPF4 is on a sort of plan-led system. So they're very much favouring allocated land, and then the policy 16F is to deal with unallocated land. So the MAFLR and a whole series of new acronyms, which everyone's going to have to get to grips with in NPF4, the MAFLR being one of them, the minimum all tenure housing land requirements. So that there's actually an ongoing argument, which features in Moss End and will continue on to the Court of Session in terms of what exactly this MAFLR figure, what use can be made of it, whether it's principally intended as an instruction for development planning, for fixing the local housing land requirement in new style local development plans, which are coming forward in light of National Planning Framework 4, or whether it has some use as a housing land requirement target or figure in its own right. And that's, we'll have to wait and see what the Court of Session have to say on that.
One of the criticisms I hear from developers is that you get different times of planning processes, different results from different local authorities. They're also criticising NPF4, but isn't NPF4 actually trying to weed out these differences and provide a framework for consistency?
I think there are certain aspects of NPF4 which will do that, but there are other aspects of NPF4 which will delay development and have significant implications for development.
What are they in particular, so Janice?
It is policy 5, I think, relates to development on sites which have peat. Now, the majority of sites in the Central Belt of Scotland will have peat of some description, and the 5 aspects within policy 5 really just allow the computer to say, no, you can't develop on that site. So those sort of elements within NPF4 are particularly challenging, because, you know, there is a real need to deliver housing, but how can you deliver housing when you have someone at the end are assessing an application that is saying, no, it doesn't meet the requirements of policy 5, when there's 28, 29, however many policies that need to be read in the round, and the development should be considered in the round. But you can't just focus in on one particular aspect if that's what suits a particular planner or a particular local authority or a particular site. Everything needs to be considered in the round.
Cameron, have you got any thoughts on that?
Yes. Well, it is a radical change, having this national planning framework as part of the development plan. There is a centralisation there at the national level. In terms of what the implications will be for decision making across local authorities, I think it's too early to tell, really. And we're still in that bedding in period, and more guidance and more experience will be required before I think we can really comment on what the implications of having this national plan are. But there's an interesting focus to this plan. There's obviously a big focus on the climate and nature crisis. There's emphasis on biodiversity gain and socioeconomic benefits and reusing sites. And there is some interesting stuff in there, and it'll be interesting to see how it all pans out in the end.
There certainly has been a negative backlash to some aspects of it. Goodness knows why 20-minute neighbourhoods have been thrown at the Scottish Government with quite such virulence, but it seems to be a concept that people are uncomfortable with. There are other aspects in terms of consultation, I think, that maybe Janice mentioned earlier, that maybe the aspiration to consult so much is a problem in terms of getting everything done within the timescales. The planners defending themselves, I think the head of Planning Scotland, I think his name is Ian Aikman, has come back very strongly and said, it's not just us, the developers don't always give us the plans in the most useful or correct or best prepared form. But he also says, we're going to need 700 new planners over the next 10 to 15 years. We need to get these processes in place so we've got planners to replace the ones who are going to be retiring soon. There's a demographic time bomb, he says, in that so many planners are over 50 and are coming up for retirement. So, there does seem to be quite a major practical difficulty in delivering NPEF 4, even if reading it, it seems like quite a sensible and aspirational document at a time when we've got climate change, at a time when we've got homelessness and all the rest of it, and we want to build more attractive neighbourhoods. Any final comments on all of these issues, either of you?
I think the loss of experienced planners is a significant challenge. There is only one undergraduate planning course in Scotland now, which again is a significant challenge when you're looking to recruit 700 new planners. And I would say that if you are a new graduate planner starting out in a planning department, you need guidance and you need assistance from experienced personnel around you, and that is a challenge if your line manager is still working from home, you're working from home, you don't get to hear the conversation in the office, you don't get a broader understanding. So I think that is something that needs to be considered. It's a challenge, I think, for a number of sectors who still have home working. But I think also it is really important that there is feedback given to us as developers and contractors when we're making applications. If we aren't giving planners what they're looking for, they need to tell us what it is they want. It's almost like doing a post-project review. If we had given you something else, would it have worked better? And that we never get that feedback from planning, and that to me is something that could be implemented quite quickly. People could be told, you know, it would have been better if we'd had X, Y, and Z, or if, you know, if we'd had two meetings instead of three meetings, or whatever, just to help the system along. But if the feedback isn't given, then you just continue to put in the information that you've always given, and people don't know whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent. So I think, you know, there's probably some quite simple things that could be done to help everyone.
And Cameron, any thoughts on that?
Yes, it's a very interesting point that Janice makes there. I mean, I think there is an ever-growing list of topics and issues which are coming across planning officers' desks, particularly in light of National Planning Framework 4, and it is a great time to be getting into planning. There's obviously a real resourcing risk and issue there, so I would encourage anyone who's interested in planning, if they're at that stage in their career, to pursue it. It's a good time to be getting into the field.
Right, thanks, Cameron. And Janice, I can't let you go without mentioning that MacTaggart Construction was named Business of the Year in the Scottish Women's Awards this year. How proud a moment is that for the business and yourself, really?
It was great, actually, because when you work in a predominantly male-dominated environment, to actually be recognised in a room full of ladies is quite an honour. So, and I said to the team that, you know, all right, it was my name that was called out at the event, and I went up and picked up the award, but I wouldn't have been there if it hadn't been for every single one of the team. So I'm very grateful for the hard work that they do every day.
It's very modest. You're the managing director of a very successful construction company, so I'm sure the award was well deserved. Thanks again to Janice Russell from MacTaggart Construction, Cameron Gregg from Morton Fraser, to Jimmy Black, and myself, Kieran Finlay. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Thank you.